This is Rusty Gaffney. You're listening to Penophile Live. Today's issue is Volume 6, Issue 62, dated July 19th, 2008. I'm lucky today to have Jay Selman from Grape Radio sitting in. As you recall, he joined me on a program a few weeks ago, and now I can't get rid of him. He wants to join in as often as possible. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks very much. Who wouldn't want to hang with the prince? I mean, come on.
Well, you know, Jay, this issue's about the golden age of artisans. I was thinking back when I grew up in the 50s. There was no such thing as artisan foods. There was no farmers markets that I recall. Organic was a foreign word. All the meals we ate were pretty much came from a can or frozen. There wasn't near the a choice of artisan fresh foods that we have today. And so I devoted this issue to a lot of smaller producers who are artisan winemakers. I think we'll lead off today with a discussion of Paul Lotto. And you know Paul well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's appropriate we can talk about him. He's quite a respected winemaker. It's interesting as I talk to some of the other winemakers in California, even though he's only had a few vintages, he started with 2002, he's already developed quite a reputation and people highly respect him.
Yeah, I think I met him first at, I believe it was the World of Pinot, tried his wine. And I go, man, this is good. You know, I mean, this is this kind of visceral reaction. And he's a compelling person, too.
Mm-hmm. He is compelling. And he's we use this word passion a lot. Mm-hmm. We talk about winemakers and people have passion. But he uses passion. You just feel it when you're around him. And he's very particular about the way he makes his wine. He declassifies any barrels, any portion of the wine that doesn't meet a very, very high standard. And as a result, he's not going to be rich doing what he's doing. He does do some other winery work and consulting work, but for his own label, he's so meticulous and so particular about quality that he'll never make a large amount of wine. Fortunately for us, we know about him, we buy his wine, and enjoy his wine immensely.
Yeah, I'm glad you're talking about him, and I'm actually a little bit surprised because I thought you might hold it against him. He also makes a Syrah, and I thought, well, that might disqualify him from recognition.
I like his Syrah. I have had it numerous times. You know, his quote, distant mentor for Syrah is the Chauve family. Mm. That's who he tries to model his wines after. And that's not a bad one to choose.
I didn't know that, but yeah. I remember my first reaction when I tasted his Syrah was Hermitage. So yeah. that's an interesting comment he made.
And his other mentor on the Pinot side is the late Henri Jaillet. Again, not a bad role model.
There is something else about Paul that is particularly impressive to me. I mean, he's doing this basically on a shoestring kind of budget. It's not like he has all this investors and that kind of stuff.
No investors, no. And,
I mean, he's doing everything himself.
That's right.
And I kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, it's a true he's a true artisan. Mm. I mean, when you think of artisan, that's kind of what you think of. Somebody going it alone and managing everything himself. You know, he's a character. He's got a great sense of humor. He had mentioned to me that when I saw him at World of Pinot Noir, he said, you know, I was smart to be a prince because kings just sit around doing nothing with their clothes off. And princes actually run the show.
That's
he
true.
Says they're the most knowledgeable and know what's going on. So that's a perfect example.
I guess that makes me a serf. But the other thing about Paul, you say he's a character, but he's also rather, in my opinion, rather shy and humble.
Yeah, no, he doesn't seek the limelight.
Yeah.
But if you get to know him and you can bring him out, and he's quite delightful to be around. I didn't mention Paolotto sources grapes from California's Central Coast. Several good vineyard sources, and he crafts his wine in Santa Maria Valley, and the wines are sold through a mailing list on his website. As I say, they're very, very limited production, and you won't see a lot of press on him or his wines because he doesn't submit the wines for judging, but you can trust Jay and I that his Pinot Noirs match up with anything made in California today, really.
Not that it means anything. I'm on his list. And speaking of that, it's interesting, just again, give you an idea of his kind of mental set is, I think I had to call 3 times to get on the list because he'd write it down on a piece of paper, wouldn't get in the database, or he'd forget. Yeah. You know, it's just, again, he's so focused on making the wine, all this business stuff is like, you know.
Right.
So sometimes you may have to be a little bit persistent to make sure that you get on the list.
Yeah, don't give up easy.
Exactly.
The next artisan I'd like to talk about is Thomas Brown. And again, he's a low-profile winemaker. I actually met him for the first time a couple months ago. I went up to Calistoga and went to his house. He actually welcomed me there and did some tasting of his 2007 Pinot Noirs. And he's an interesting guy, very bright, very cerebral. He hails from South Carolina, was educated at University of Virginia, and he majored in English literature and game theory. Now, those are exactly the things you want to do to become a winemaker, right?
Game theory. Wow, that's a good one. Wow.
And he told me he arrived in California in 1996. He loved wine and he wanted to get in the game. And he just started knocking on doors. He had no connections. He knew nobody. He was just fortunate to be hired by Aaron Jordan at Turley. And Aaron Jordan subsequently introduced him to Scott and Joan Zeller, who own Summa Vineyard in the Occidental region of the Sonoma Coast. And this led to him finding other vineyard sources in the Occidental region. And so he concentrates all his Pinot Noir production on that small Occidental Freestone area, which is very close to the Pacific Coast, very cool. And he, again, makes very small amounts. I think his total production is 600 cases, 650 for 2007. He told me there are 4,000 people on his waiting list. So unless you're currently on the mailing list, the chances of you getting his wine are very slim, but it is available on the secondary market. I've occasionally seen a bottle here or there at retail stores. You know, just keep your ears peeled for the wine, and you might want to cross it sometime. And if you do get a chance, try it. And I know a number of winemakers who are in tasting groups, and they taste Pinot Noirs frequently, and I know that Thomas Brown's Pinot Noirs always do well in blind tastings with other California Pinot Noirs. And I should mention that his brand is not Thomas Brown. It's Rivers Marie. That's because his middle name is Rivers, and his wife's middle name is Marie.
Oh, so he's a romantic, too.
Yes, yes.
I met him, by the way, when he was at Turley.
Oh,
so it's kind of, again, you didn't hold it against him.
No.
Coming over from the dark side into
and actually, he makes wine for 15 other labels. He makes a lot of cab. He works out of Napa, and he makes Schrader. He makes some other prominent wines. He also has a second Pinot Noir project with Schrader, which is called Aston Estate. And these are wines that are a little bigger, more intense, a little different style than the Rivers Marie, which tends to be a little more demure and elegant. I tasted through his 2007 barrel samples, and I was just blown away. I mean, they're just incredible wines. It's no wonder that people are clamoring to get his wines. But again, here's a guy who's very committed to quality, doesn't make a lot, deals with the mailing list and the marketing and the selling of the wines himself, and fortunately has other winemaking jobs to support this particular artisan habit. But you have to admire the guy. I mean, he's got a vision for what he wants to do. It's very unique. I don't know of any other producer only making Pinot Noir from Occidental Freestone area like he does. And as you know, some of the best Pinot Noir, unfortunately, is made in very small amounts. It's hard to get your hands on. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it and alert people to this type of people.
You know, a lot of people listening to this may not realize how important it is for these guys to basically, you know, make wine for a number of different producers. This is not the sort of job you do to get rich.
Right.
I mean, think about it. You basically got to work all these different jobs to make an income that you can survive on.
Right.
And so there's got to be something else into it for them. And again, we use the word passion, but, you know, this focus, this discipline, this passion, whatever you want to call it, is required to, you know, when you're thinking in those kind of minuscule quantities.
Yeah. Well, check out his website, riversmarie.com. It's with a hyphen, and it's very informative, the website, by the way. The third artisan winemaker I want to talk about today is Augie Hugg of Hugg Cellars. He's an interesting guy because his background was really in the oil fields, drilling gas wells, oil wells, geothermal wells, and he actually continues to do that as in a consulting role today. And that type of work, I guess, has ups and downs. It has slow periods and busy periods. And in the mid-1980s, he became a chef and owner of a small restaurant, I guess as a kind of a insurance measure because things were slow at that time. And he developed a love for wine at that time and an interest in wine-food partnership. He told me his wine epiphany was a Heights Martha's Cabernet Sauvignon, the 1974 vintage.
Yeah.
Not a bad epiphany.
Yeah.
So in 1993, he bought a small wine shop and tasting room in Harmony, which is in California's Central Coast. It's a tiny little spot just south of Cambria. It was called the Central Coast Wine Room, and he just focused on small artisan wine producers. But it was through owning the shop that he became friends and met many people in the wine business. And one winemaker in particular was John Albin of Albin Vineyards. And he kind of took Augie under his wings. And in 1994, Augie launched Hugg Cellars with 87 cases of Syrah made from grapes from Albin Vineyards. And he went on from there. He's actually in Paso Robles now. He has his own winery. He made his first Pinot Noir in 2001. He makes about 1,700 cases from four different sources, entirely Central Coast, like Rancho Andoveras, excellent sources. I really hadn't got into his wines that much until this past year, and I had the opportunity to taste his whole lineup, and I was really quite impressed. I think Augie knows what he's doing. His wines aren't over-stylized. They're not fruit bomb trendy Pinot Noirs. Even though he seems like kind of a big guy, works in the oil fields, but his wines don't reflect that personality. Again, very small production, but his wines are more available. He's not in that cult class yet, so that you can obtain his wines through a mailing list.
He's an interesting. Here's a guy who's really an interesting character, and I got to tell you one quick little story. I hope he's not listening because he'll get mad at this. Maybe I always liked his wines, but when pressed one time, he could see I was holding back on saying something. Oh, you know, tell me. I go, "Well, your labels are butt ugly. I'm sorry. I just don't like them." You know, and to his credit, actually, he gave that some thought, asked some people, and. Really, not because of my comment, but it started something, and he did a tweak to the label, and actually, I like it a lot better now.
Yeah.
And so it's just, I mean, something so trivial like that, and you think that to me, again, that attention to detail is a good indicator of someone who's going to produce great wine.
Yeah, I agree. And I agree with the label. It's much better now.
Sorry, Augie, if you're listening. But he's got, that guy is so much fun to hang with. Oh, my God. You know, the number of off lines I've done with him, it's just, he's a blast.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. So those are just a few examples of what's available in the Pinot Noir world from small artisan producers. Let's shift gears here a little bit, Jay. You know we're in a recession, or I don't know if you know you're, because a guy like you has so much money, you probably are recession-proof.
No, yeah, right.
But it's interesting to think about how the recession affects premium wine business. In this particular issue, I reviewed probably 50 Pinot Noirs, and the average price was $54. That's not an amount of money to sneeze at. And there's some evidence, some reports have come out that high-end wines are beginning to suffer a decrease in sales. What do you think, Jay? Do you think premium wine, we're talking about Pinot Noir, but it could apply to any wine, the recession will have any effect on
that? Absolutely. In my own personal life, and I can't believe it's that different than for other people. Reality is I'm making less money and things are more expensive. And so I've got to make choices. I got to make cuts. That includes some of these premium wines you're talking about. I think, though, that what's interesting for me, at least, is that I've noticed that it's not so much where I'm buying, let's say, a cheaper wine, but I'm just buying less of it and being much more selective than I used to be. I took it for granted in the past. Now I don't do that anymore. I got to believe most people are kind of like that.
Yeah, I think you just focus more specifically on particular wines that you really want.
Right.
And you buy those, and maybe not quite as much as you bought before. You know, there's a couple things I've noticed. These are just observations. When I go into retail wine stores, which I do frequently, it seems like there's less traffic, less people in there. The customer to help ratio has changed. That's just a observation I made.
Well, this time of the year there will be. I mean, this is not exactly the best time of the year for wine.
But it's been for a while.
Yeah.
The second thing is that there's a lot more wine for sale on the auction market.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Tremendous number of sellers, partial sellers being auctioned off. I don't know what that means. Do you remember the movie Repo Man?
Sure.
Well, I was thinking that we could start a new business called Wine Repo Man. And so, you know, when people get into a little bit of trouble, we go in and we remove their wines and sell it.
There is a thriving business for people who actually do that. Go in, evaluate the seller, sell them. And your point is well taken about the auction market or secondary market. There is a lot more. Even people flipping their wine or selling their allocation right away, like, even offering it for cost, you know, not even trying to get profit, but I can't afford it this year, but I don't want to get dropped off the list, that kind of thing. For me, it's tougher now, especially with a daughter going to college, and I got to pay for college, and that was brutally expensive. So yeah, it's unfortunate. I don't like having to cut back, but that's the reality I got to face.
Yeah. You know, and shipping is another big issue. Shipping costs have just really escalated.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't even used to think about it when you ordered wine because the shipping cost was 10, 12 bucks or something, it seemed like. And now it's just, it's a significant amount of money.
And I also go out to dinner less. I mean, I typically like to go out to dinner, open some bottles, that kind of thing. And again, you know, when you're faced with that kind of restaurant bill and the corkage and all that kind of stuff, you cut out one a week, that can have an impact on you.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure restaurants are feeling it a little bit. I think maybe people have more of a tendency at times like this to bring their own wine, particularly when, you know, they're aware of the value of wines and people that are knowledgeable about wine. You go into a restaurant and you see a wine marked up three times over wholesale, you know.
Right.
That's a hard chunk of money to throw away.
The best advice I could give people in these kind of times is establish a budget for yourself.
Yeah.
I know in the past I tended to make these impulse buys and not thinking about the overall kind of thing. Now, I mean, I live by that budget. That's it. You know, I go into a store, if I buy a bottle, guess what? It goes against my budget. You got to be disciplined.
I think that's a great idea. And another thing that I found is a lot of times I'll see something and I'll think, ah, I really want that. Wait a day or two. Don't buy it on impulse. Wait a couple days and think about it. And I think you'll find that some of the times you won't buy that. You'll think about it and say, well, you know, do I really need it? Do I really want it? I think we're all victims of being impulse buyers because we love wine so much. And we just say, ah, I got to have that, got to have that. And I think use some restraint, you know, wait, give it a few days. Think about it because it's very rare that you have to buy it right then.
That's true.
Once in a while, there are like sellers available that become available. And if you don't act right away, you're not going to get it. But if you don't get it, there's always other wine. I mean, it's not like it's the only wine out there.
You and I have taken, a pretty good approach in that times we've shared an allocation. And that's cool, not only because you order the maximum you can and kind of keep your allocations high, but it's almost like a virtual seller because now between us, we have six bottles versus three.
Right.
So that works out great for me. I get double the opportunities to drink the wines.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I'm looking at is, you know, the car dealers now, car sales are way down. Mm-hmm. So they're offering 0% financing. So I'm waiting for wineries to start doing that. 0% financing for a year.
I'm surprised nobody's come out with a credit card just for wine, something where you get points, something, you know, just on the wine.
That's a great idea. Really?
Can you imagine that? Would be recognized by retailers. Maybe they offer a little discount because you got this card or something like that. That would be cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Jay. I think we pretty much covered it today. And as always, enjoy your comments and your company. I'll invite you back.
I would like that.
Thanks very much.